your eye like a big pizza pie. That's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing the bell.
And welcome back to another episode of Political Football, episode 13, numero uno. If anything, this week has shown us is that love knows no bounds, including the New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, facing some hot pressure from New South Wales ICAC in relation to her dealings with Mr. Daryl Maguire. We'll get into that shortly, but we'll also be discussing the opposition budget reply. Obviously, last week we outlined the government, the LNP government's budget. This week we'll be looking at the alternative vision that Anthony Albanese delivered to the Australia last Thursday, as well as a big week of sport this week. What do we got in sport, Joe?
Mate, big prelim weekend coming up. I've been pretty excited for this. It's been an amazing finals run so far. So we've got Raiders Storm kicking off tonight. It's going to be huge. And then obviously Souths versus Penrith tomorrow night, which I'm very excited to see. Based off what happened last week.
Yeah, bump around this coming weekend. I think you couldn't ask for a better game set of games. And the Roosters, ring-a-ding-ding, the king is dead. So is the Roosters. So thank God for that. Goodbye to all those Roosters fans who listen to the show, on the to the podcast on a current basis. But getting back into our first topic, Hurricane Gladys. So let me just lead off by saying, I think obviously if you haven't been living under a rock this week, you'd have some understanding of what's happened in relation to Gladys, is that, like the rest of us, she's allowed to have a private life, and the relationship she had with Daryl Maguire is no one else's business, as Albanese and a variety of other commentators in the political sphere have noted. But the point of conjecture is whether her relationship with Daryl Maguire, in any respect, personal, friendship, whatever capacity, blindsided her in relation to turning a blind eye to corruption in relation to his business dealings around Badgerys Creek and other financial deals that he may have otherwise used his personal office as an MP, as a Wagga Wagga MP, for personal gain. And that is a definition of corruption. But before we get and dig a little more below the surface, sorry, it's quite early in the morning and the big fella's struggling. But before we get into the finer details of it, Joe, your thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, mate, she's been caught with her hands in the cookie jar, hasn't she? I don't know. I'm just waiting, really, to see what more comes out of this, because it's obviously hard, as you said, to separate her private life, which she's entitled to entirely, and whether she's actually caught up in the corruption of it. So, I mean, that's what the investigation's about. That's what the investigation's for. So I'm happy to trust what comes out of there. It's you'd want to hope she's not involved with it over her stature right now, New South Wales Premier. But yeah, I mean, it'd be a bit of a mess. It's a bad look. Like, it's a terrible look, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think in the grand scheme of things, in terms of corruption, you know, obviously ICAC does a relatively good job in relation to their findings and prosecution and enforcement of the parliamentary guidelines around corruption. But I think the key thing is we can't go sort of... The whole reason I feel like this is taken off is because of the whole sort of sex sells thing, you know, like... That whole sort of relationship, or, you know, it's like one of those things, you know, they'll probably make a drama about this in a couple of years, you know. But I think that'd just be taken, that should be taken out of the spotlight. We should focus on the actual matter of the corruption we're dealing with here.
So, one thing I don't want to see is her being personally attacked based on her personal decisions of who she decides to be with and who she decides to spend her time with. Like, I think in situations like this, it annoys me so much when you just see personal attacks and them going at her individual self. But this, if anything, is about her leadership style, what she does as a leader. So if definitely question her professional integrity, but I hope this doesn't turn into an ugly just destruction of her personal social life.
I feel like I don't think it's been there isn't that much of a gender element to it, but I do feel like some of the questioning has been a bit onerous directly to her, you know, asking about the, you know, she, like, you know, why did she stay with him, you know, for 2 years after she sacked him as a minister when she found out about this stuff in 2018. Like, how could you carry out that personal relationship? Like, that's different, right? You know, people can choose, you know, whatever they want. Whether, you know, it wouldn't matter if you went to jail if she still carried out the relationship. That wouldn't matter to me.
Mm.
But if we get back to the essence of what's going on here, that Daryl Maguire in 2017 used his office and its staff to conduct the personal business in relation to a land deal with the Waterhouse family. Around the New Badgerys Creek airport site, which seems to be riddled with dealings with corruption, because I'm not sure if you heard, but a couple of weeks ago, the federal government got done by the Auditor General's office in saying that they bought a piece of land that wouldn't be required to 2050 for $33 million rather than $3 million. So they bought it for 10 times above market price, and they actually found out the owners of that land were a couple of billionaires who had previously donated to the Liberal Party. Right. So that's a bit more... red-handed, if you ask me, but again, the definition of corruption: using your public office in the public sector, using your public office for personal gain. Mm. That seems to what happened here, because effectively he was using this deal to pay off 50% of his gross debt. Mm. He was all about financial deals and all that sort of stuff. And the evidence brought before the ICAC hearings included a phone transcript whereby Maguire refers to good news about the deal potentially going through, and the Premier says, "I don't need to know about that." About that bit, which seems quite damning.
So it's seeming like she may have known, but she's taken the conscious stance to separate herself from it.
Yeah, that's right. So I think again, we're not saying the Premier's not been involved in the deal per se, but it goes to her judgment, and she's turned a blind eye. To me, for someone who's sort of watched New South Wales politics for years, it doesn't surprise me. New South Wales economy isn't particularly diverse. We've got a strong services sector, strong financial services, you know, obviously decent agricultural and a small scale manufacturing, but a lot of our economy is built in property because of how we've got a huge property sector in New South Wales, and given some of the dealings that other people I've talked to who work in the public service, you know, it's no surprise to me that there is, you know, some fishy water around land deals.
What you were saying about that text, it kind of makes me think about the duty of care. It's like, as an educator, a future educator, teacher, I'm going to have a duty of care over the students. So if I see or hear anything that doesn't sound good or doesn't sound right and could be resulting in them being in any danger or harm, I have a duty of care to report, make a mandatory report about that, whether I like it or not. So if she knew about it and decided not to say anything, she's just breaking her duty of care, really, for her job. So
And I think this goes back to a broader narrative around how we view corruption and how we always look to cure the, treat the incident rather than sort of prevent it. I feel like there's not enough education around corruption. Like, you never learn about corruption in school or values or ethics. I think there could be a bigger focus on that in terms of the education program, both in terms of ministers in the public office understanding their rules, because there are lots of codes, there are lots of different things that cross over, you know, and you might do more harm than good in the sense that they're just so convoluted. But again, that doesn't take away from your responsibility to know. You're a minister. Your job is to represent the public interest. And when you go ahead and conduct a secondary job like this outside of your office, that's when that is conflicted. And that's when your position becomes untenable. But in saying that, if we go to a broader narrative around the alternatives, right? So if saying Gladys should resign, who comes in place? And the options around her are not crash hot. They're probably worse than her. So it's a combination of, is she really that good to lose before an election? When you've got people like Dominic Perrottet, who we've covered a whole episode around iCare, episode 7, I believe that was, in which we discussed what a nightmare iCare was, and he was the guy who created it. And you got members, including my local MP, one of my favourites, John Sidoti, who used his direct office of personal financial gain. Now, how he is still there, it is beyond my words, because he effectively bought with the Northwest Rail Link. He was a parliamentary secretary to the Department of Planning and Infrastructure, and he used his office and information around where the train line would be back in 2015 to go ahead and buy land, a spare land. He put a 10% deposit down, so effectively 40,000 of a $400,000 purchase. And 6 months later, the land was rezoned, and they sold it to a shopping center company who was going to build a shopping center right near it for $70 million. So he turned that $40,000 into $7 million effectively within 12 months. Now that is a disgrace, and he's still there. He's still got the office down there. Now you wouldn't be able to see him. I got to put an APB on his ass because you just can't find him anywhere. He's buried. You call his office, they're not there. It's just ridiculous. So if anyone's listening, anyone, John Sidoti's personal family members, you know where I am. You come see me, I'll be outside the bank. But anyway, sorry I went on a bit of a tangent there, but just going to your broader narrative around corruption and how you think it could be prevented rather than this continuing cycle of IACAC investigating, someone getting found out, and the same thing to and fro.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. How I see it is, there's like one of two stances that you can take. It's like, do you put a hard, firm restriction on it where if anyone's caught, they lose their job sort of thing and they have to resign? Or do you try and allow for redemption? Because as you said, the other options for Gladys's job aren't so crash hot. So maybe making her resign could have a bigger fallout than the actual corruption case itself. So that's something I think has to be thought about. Like, I'd like to see a way where people are allowed to redeem themselves, because, I mean, one mistake doesn't always define your whole career unless you're impacting other people's lives in a catastrophic way. But yeah, I think there should be a chance for her to redeem herself. And I think that'll say a lot, and it'll obviously make her learn a lesson for the future of her career. And so I don't think there should just be a hard stance of resign immediately. I think there should be a buffer period of redemption, and I think that can say a lot about someone in her position and going forward. So
for sure.
It's very hard, I guess, because still the investigation's not over. So I don't think any rash decision right now is going to be more beneficial than if we just wait it out, see what the investigation says, and then take our time. I think rushing isn't going to help anyone.
Agreed. You're a man of principle, and I've got to respect that. But moving on there, I think we've covered off that pretty well. Again, it's been an interesting topic. It's one of those topics that everyone seems to be having an opinion on. But all means, all our viewers out there, if you're listening, by all means, send in your thoughts via our Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram page. But moving on now to the major point of political football in terms of the political side today. The opposition leader last Thursday night delivered his budget in reply speech. Obviously, it's a right of reply every year, something that I look forward to, especially while the ALP is in opposition, because you actually deliver some meaningful policy. But before we get into the sort of philosophical sort of debate that we had, obviously last week we analysed the strengths, weaknesses, and perhaps the missed opportunities in terms of the value and size of the debt that the LNP is delivering. This week, in the budget reply, Albanese delivered his alternative vision and singled out some specific policies that the budget missed, because obviously that's what you're trying to target, is things that were missed in the budget. Number one was his childcare policy, which by Labor government by 1 July 22 will remove the annual cap on the childcare subsidy, eliminating the disincentive for women to work more hours, and increasing the maximum childcare subsidy to 90%, cutting costs for 97% of all families in the system. So effectively going to a universal childcare system with a reduced amount of out-of-pocket costs, and ensuring that all the dollars spent on it flow directly towards savings for Australian families. So Joe, your thoughts on this policy before I give my rationale behind while it's logical and good?
Yeah, huge, massive way to start off. Childcare is always something that's going to catch the attention of a lot of people. To me, this is a no-brainer. I think I'm a firm believer that just because you have a kid, that doesn't mean that should limit the way and the chances and the opportunities you have to work. So I'm a massive fan of this policy. Tell us more.
Yep. So in terms of this, you got to look at this in terms of an investment. So the Grattan Institute, their research highlights for every dollar invested in childcare, you get a minimum of $2 in growth back. So that goes back to increased participation of females in the workplace. So if you have a more universal childcare system like this policy introduces, and it reduces it, it takes away the disincentive for women to work more than 3 days a week, which in the current system, if you like, say if your partner's earning over $80,000, I think, then if you do work more than 3 days a week, you lose your, like the amount of your childcare subsidy is reduced. That the effective tax rate, it can be 95% up to 100% once you start going above the 80,000 threshold. So there's no incentive for women to work that extra 2 days. So the economy loses out on potentially extra 2 days of work, and also the productive capacity that that delivers.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Is it, would something like this then make it more compulsory for women to return to work sooner, or?
It just gives them the choice.
Okay, so it gives, so they can still take more time
if
they
don't want to work.
I mean, I'm not a woman and I haven't had a child, but I have heard of cases where women aren't ready to return to work yet. Yeah. They want to take extra time. So I was just wondering if this forces them to come back to work sooner and more regularly. But if not, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, again, because there are going to be some of those cases, but they're going to be on the fringes. A lot of, you know, women graduate from university more so than men. They've been graduating at a higher rate, so effectively they've got a higher sort of, you know, higher qualifications. That effectively that this is going to waste because of a disincentive to work for the childcare policy. Remember all the unpaid work that women do in the workforce in relation to care, not only in childcare but obviously in aged care, and just they're the backbone of the care economy. So this injects more money into the childcare sector at a cost of $6.2 billion. It's supposed to deliver $4 billion in productivity and participation each year. So that cost of $6.2 billion is over 4 years. You take that $4 billion, you multiply it by 4, you get $16 billion. So what it returns, this is not a welfare measure, as Albanese mentioned in his speech. It is an economic measure because, as I said last week, the three P's, one of those P's is participation. You get more with females in the workforce, you get more working hours, you get greater participation, you get greater productivity. It delivers, it's a great organic way to grow. Again, that's why we talked about this election being a bit gender blind, because you think they'd do something around childcare because it's a huge, there's lots of out of pokeit costs, but again, they've gone for the blokey bloke budget in terms of hard hats and manufacturing and all that sort of stuff that they love being in announcements, because Morrison's the announcement artist. But moving on from that, obviously it's pretty clear, I think everyone who's got a brain would support that policy, so get around me. And moving on now to the second point of Albanese's speech, which was around manufacturing, which is a future made in Australia. That's what he was titling it. And he was to build on the success of the Infrastructure Australia model to create Jobs and Skills Australia. He quoted this by saying, this is about joining up the needs of the economy now with training opportunities for the future. Obviously, we talked about it last week. We have a shortage of nurses, welders, bricklayers, engineers and hairdressers. Yet the government has cut 140,000 fewer spots since its induction in 2013. And we obviously want to deliver Australian jobs with a good, secure future. So again, one something that's going to deliver very good public value for money, creating the Australian Skills Guarantee, with every major work site receiving federal government funding, 1 out of 10 workers employed will be an apprentice, trainee or cadet. So again, I think this is a very sort of rational policy. A rational policy, again, delivers, again, it goes sort of the contrary notion of the Liberal Party more indirect measures, you know, picking winners and losers around manufacturing. They delivered a $1.5 billion manufacturing fund that was for like food and beverage, space and a variety of other sectors. But this one, it doesn't discriminate against industry. So it allows for the effective allocation of resources to where our comparative advantages lie. Your thoughts on this policy, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the help's got to go to wherever's needed the most. So, yeah, I mean, I still want to know more about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty lost on this one, actually. Can you just give us another quick little like overview of what you mean, of what this means?
So Jobs and Skills Australia, their funding model would be that it's a one-stop shop. So they'd be able to allocate the training and resource. So so effectively this is recouping an extra 140,000 spots that the government has cut because of the funding over the last 7 years. So for those doing an apprenticeship, traineeship, it brings forward and also gives them a guarantee that they'll get some return on their investment in their education by actually being allowed to, by actually being incentivized for workplaces to go on as an apprentice, trainee and cadet. And obviously once you get into that capacity, that it increases your chances to for a long-term job, especially in manufacturing. And it also, as I said, the Australian skills guarantee that they're focused on here has actually ensured that they eradicate those shortages of nurses as well as bricklayers, engineers and hairdressers, because there's a shortage of engineering trades. Obviously, nurses and the care economy is significant. Welders, even like mechanics, there's a shortage of those. Hairdressers, I'm not sure about that one, but if the research is there, then that combines about that. But it's just, again, it's providing a guarantee for industry, provides certainty. And as an economist, one of the key things industry needs is certainty around the long-term investment policy. And this prioritises jobs, which again, this has been the key focus of the government. It just depends on which angle you take. The more indirect investment and incentive that the Liberal Party is taking, or this one, which actually guarantees long-term certainty for the industry and goes through the training and training route rather than the indirect route.
Do you think long-term certainty in these sort of industries, though, is hard to predict, though, in terms of, like, industries change, the need for jobs in industries change, like industries boom and bust. So do you think long-term security is hard to set your sight on when things change so often?
Well, in some instances it might be, but in this instance, we're always going to need nurses.
No, I mean nurses.
Welders.
Nurses, welders, yeah, even bricklayers, etc. But, you know, like in the types of industries that boom and bust, is it hard to set your sight and focus on long-term security where sometimes their booms and busts can be short-term fixated?
I don't believe so in this capacity, because I've heard of those industries that we're talking about there, you might be looking at something like mining or car manufacturing, where it just becomes transition. But there's still going to be jobs now that created in this space, and there's still going to be jobs in the future, because again, these have always been we've always had these jobs, and they'll always be there because we need some domestic capacity, and there's always going to be demand for these roles. Unlike the car manufacturing industry, which the Liberal Party made sure was quickly out of the country in 2013, tens of thousands of jobs in manufacturing supply chain were thrown out the door. So a bit rich when they're investing $1.5 billion in manufacturing, when they've clearly gone ahead and thrown these people to the war that clearly weren't part of their voter base. But moving on now to energy policy, the Labor Party said they were going to establish a new Rewiring the Nation Corporation to rebuild and modernise the national energy grid. This one's a big tick for me. The incentives are there. The economics behind this is solid. The Australian industry, energy market industry report came out. They've got like 15 projects that are ready to go in terms of modernising the energy grid, in terms of transmission. So we have, it'll help drive down the cost of energy for all Australians. And the rebuilding of the grid will create thousands of jobs. You can imagine how many jobs it creates, particularly in regional Australia, which obviously has been, they've done well in terms of the coronavirus, but they've always had historically higher unemployment in urban areas, and it'll deliver up to $40 billion in benefits. So at a maximum, you're looking at a $20 billion investment, but you get a $40 billion return in benefits. So again, slightly different approach here to the coalition, more direct investment, greater direct benefit to the community. And it also goes well with our logical policy that the net zero by 2050, which obviously is a key goal for the future of the way we live.
Are we talking, by modernise, are we talking renewables? Is that what we're talking here?
Yeah. So that definitely play increasing role in it. But it's also upbuilding the capacity for the grid. So as we transition away from coal and dispatchable power per se, and moving to renewables, the grid's going to be needed to be upgraded. Obviously the size of the energy sources has changed, so that changes the way in which it's transmitted. So again, I'm not an expert in the direct aspects of how it works, but the Australian Energy Market Operator Integrated System Plan has given 15 projects by 2030 that would need to be conducted. And this just brings that forward and incentivizes it. And because the Commonwealth's ability to borrow at the lowest interest rates, effectively at zero, because how cheap, I think it's like 0.5% they borrow, it'll be done at the lowest possible cost. So you're effectively applying cost base, and it makes a lot of sense. And it's contrary to the LNP, who have had 22 energy policies in 8 years, providing business with great uncertainty and leading to more expensive energy prices. Obviously, we've seen New South Wales have privatised the electricity grid, and energy prices went skyrocketing. For a place like Australia, when you think about it, the abundance of energy that we have, and we should have the cheapest energy in the world. In fact, because of the stuff ups over the last 20, 25 years in relation to energy policy, we've had some very expensive prices. So this is something that needs to be addressed, and it's a winner all around. But moving on now to social housing. This is a big one for me. I mentioned it last week. The Economic Society of Australia and their leading economists said this is gets the greatest bang for buck in terms of fixing up housing dwellers that have roof leaks in terms of and mold and damp, and the plumbing isn't up to scratch for those social houses that already exist. I reckon there's 100,000 that are in urgent need of repair. And as Albanese pointed out in the budget reply speech, he said if these were MP's offices, they'd be fixed overnight. But because, you know, there's the most vulnerable people in there, and it's something you know, that gets put to the back burner because you can, you know, they change the agenda all the time, is these people's homes, they're a job creation plan ready and waiting. Traders could be ordering from suppliers overnight. They could be on site tomorrow, and it provides jobs almost instantaneously. Mm. Your thoughts on this one, Joe?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's what instantly comes to my mind is like, if there's any distaste in anyone's mouth who live in social housing towards government figures, this kind of thing is why. You know what I mean? Like if you're relying on a service for your health and safety day in and day out, and you're being neglected, what more do you need to be put off and have a bad taste in your mouth? So 100%, this is the way to go. It's a way to bring more people together. I feel like the longer things like this happen, the longer people are living outside, they're being seen as outsiders, not ostracized, as important. Yeah. It's just creating a bigger gap between just general functioning of society and people being happy and people being more together. So I think this is an instant way to bring people more together, especially if you want, like, I know it's about their lives and not about support for a party, but like, what better way would there to be to drive your support up and to make people trust you and get more trust around the community?
That's so, right. And I think it just goes to a broader narrative of housing, such a fundamental aspect of the way we live. Like having a roof over your head, a permanent roof over your head makes such a difference, right? Even if you come from a lower SES background, if you've got a roof over your head, it's one stable way, and then everything can sort of flow from there, right? But if you're going from house to house, from emergency accommodation and emergency accommodation, then the whole sort of stability notion of living is completely turned upside down.
And not only is it just, it's not only just the face value of them having somewhere to live that's functioning and safe. It's these sort of things that something that can set someone's life on a different trajectory. If you have a leak, if someone's house is leaking and it's leaking in the room where their kid studies, for example. If their kid might not want to study there, then they don't end up studying. They don't end up getting good grades. They can't make a life for themselves, for their future. So this is the sort of thing that will impact people's lives in the long run. So fixing their homes, giving them a more comfortable, safe space to live, is ultimately going to do more for the benefit of society in the future. I mean, that's pretty deep and philosophical, but it's true. I mean, if you grow up in somewhere that's not safe to live, you aren't going to hold on to good home values, good living values. So it's more than just the face value of fixing up a building and fixing up a house. It's investing in people's lives and their future, and giving them the best chance to succeed.
You couldn't have said it better myself. Again, it's a demand-driven policy that helps solve a pretty important social need to the most vulnerable in society, while also creating jobs. Because there's 100,000 homes that need fixing, but there's also 200,000 people on the waiting list for social housing. So there's a demand there for actually homes to be built, and that can provide a steady pipeline for work for people in the trades industry to actually go ahead, and it creates jobs. So it's pretty awesome what you can do when you put your mind to it in terms of policy and what it can deliver. So
get people up on their feet, pick them up from the ground and put them in the workforce if it works well enough. So, I mean, it's a no-brainer for me.
And we've seen during COVID effectively, especially New South Wales, Victoria, amongst other places, that homeless people that were on the streets were effectively put into emergency accommodation overnight or the other housing plans as well. So when people say this is a huge issue and it's a complex issue, it is, but don't tell me it can't be solved, like anything that you put your mind to, it can be solved. And then the final point of in terms of policy was a Labor, while we were speaking about it earlier, will deliver a national anti-corruption commission to restore faith in democracy. And if anything, this week has shown is that fundamental trust in our institutions is critical to our functioning democracy. It's long overdue and a welcome commitment. Again, it hasn't been, there's the Auditor of the General's Office and a variety of other oversight bodies, but a national anti-corruption commission that actually deals specifically with corruption is absolutely essential. As we talked about earlier, the Badgery Creek deal that they paid $33 million for a piece of land that was worth $3 million. I feel like this how could this not have anyone's support?
Yeah, I mean, go for it. It's well timed, isn't it?
Yeah.
So something makes me think maybe they timed it a little bit too.
Well, no, it's been on the radar for a good multiple years. But the Attorney General Christian Porter was supposed to deliver some sort of commission structure last year, but again, he's still been teetering on it, and he hasn't brought it forward. I wonder why that is. Again, you've got to always look at the dark arts when it comes to that.
It's really like it's attractive anti-corruption body, but it's just so annoying that it even has to be done. You know what I mean? Like, if there's just, as you were saying before, a greater incentive into educating people going into those roles to not be corrupt, like, then you're just saving all your time and money with bringing in things like this.
Yeah.
Like bringing in a whole body to oversee corruption can just be absolutely prevented if people are vetted properly going into the job. I mean, it's just frustrating to see.
I still think you need the body in a sense, because it doesn't matter all the education that you do, people are still going to break the rules. Power corrupts. It's just the way it is. It's an institutional. Just power corrupts. So you need a combined approach. You need the education, you need the enforcement, and you need the prosecution. So the education might help reduce the incidence rate. The prosecution helps put people away, and that in itself prevents people if you give harsh enough penalties, which I don't think has been the case. We've seen these things, these cases where they have been brought forward and they get done and lose their job, but then they walk into another cushy private sector role and without any sort of further prosecution or potential jail time. And the enforcement, well, again, the enforcement's a bit hard because the budget of ICAC, for example, isn't necessarily greatest. And again, I think it's responsible to the role of Premier and Cabinet, the Department of Premier and Cabinet. So again, there's ways to improve it, but that's a discussion for another day. But just moving on before we get into the sports section, obviously, we've talked about specific policies here, but the larger narrative of the budget reply, and something that I think was missing in the Treasurer's speech, and every time you hear Scott Morrison speak, is what it means for the broader vision of Australia, right? You can deal with these individual policies, but as a Prime Minister, your role is to lead and you deliver a vision for Australia. Ben Chifley did it after World War II with The Light on the Hill. Gough did it with It's Time. Bob Hawke, Keating, delivered economic reform that was meaningful for Australians, that delivered economic growth for 30 years. But we're now entering a new phase where there's great uncertainty, time pressure on politicians, people are under severe threat of losing their jobs. The role of the leader is to deliver a vision for Australia and what it means. And everyone who knows me is I'm a very proud Australian, as I know my compatriot here, Joe, is. And Mr. Albanese told this anecdote about Tom Uren, who was a sort of a father figure for himself when he was growing up. Albanese grew up without a father figure, with a single parent. But he told this story about Tom Uren, who fought in World War II. He spent his 21st birthday as a Japanese prisoner of war on the Thai-Burma Railway. And he says, Australians survived because of a simple code. The healthy looked after the sick, the strong looked after the weak, the young looked after the old. And these are the values that are at the heart of what it is to be an Australian. I don't know about you, but this really spoke to me, because it is true. And if anything, what COVID has shown us is that we're not individuals. We are a society, and that we depend on each other to get through and rely on each other to deliver a better life for ourselves. And I just thought this was really important. The healthy will go after the sick, the strong will go after the weak, and the young will go after the old. I feel like that was a bit lost as we've sort of transitioned to a sort of a more American way of lifestyle per se. And I think this gets back to the fundamentals of what Australia is built on.
Yeah, it's definitely perfect time for a core like reassessment of values, and just to drill them home and remind each other like what it's really about. As you said, big picture, very important in a time like this, especially when in like with this pandemic, everything we see is so broad, based off whether it's Australia, America, Europe. Everything we're seeing is just so massive and out there, but immediate. And it's all about like what's happening now, immediate things. Big picture is kind of taking a backseat right now to immediate instances. So it's good, yeah, good to sit back and reassess core values in the country and just remind everyone what we actually have to consider and have deep in our hearts while we go forward.
Wonderful. There we have it. That's our political side of the story told for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. I think we thoroughly enjoyed that discussion around corruption in terms of New South Wales Parliament and obviously Mr. Albanese's budget reply. Send in your thoughts. If you've got any questions, please let us know. But we'll be shortly moving on to our sports coverage of the week. Let's go. Well, there you have it. Ding a ding ding. The Roosters are dead. Gone. Buried. Finished.
Thank the Lord.
Jackie Whiten getting over there with a crucial try. An uncharacteristic mistake from the Australian fullback, James Tedesco. And what a shame it was to see his hopes of a third premiership going up in flames.
It was looking like he was...
says no one ever.
Going down to catch that ball, looked like he was running on a pair of Bega cheese stringers, mate. Twisted, gone.
Goodbye. But moving on to our sport now, of course, week two finals review. The Raiders redemption tour. The Raiders and the hopes of the three-peat for the Roosters. Getting a bit of revenge, a bit of sweet revenge on the grand final last year. Going down by 6 points to the Roosters. As I used to say in the hallowed halls of St. Patrick's College, Strathfield, Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus Dominus, Sanctus Dominus Deus. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord, holy is the Lord God of hosts. Thought I'll chuck that one in for the SPC boys. You'll still listen to the podcast. But now your thoughts on this game, Joe. Characteristic performance in the Raiders here. I thought it was essential that they hold the Roosters under 20 points. They did that. They managed to get the dub. A great try-saving tackle from Charles Nigga. Chance Charles on like a clot stud. And I'm losing the plot here. CNK, as I like to refer him to, as it's a bit easier, less of a tongue twister. You know, you now that the Eels are out, you're a bit of a Raiders fan going forward.
That's it, mate. I can kick back now and relax. No more final stress for me. Unfortunately, I'd probably rather be stressing about the finals, but nah, I'm pumped for this game. This is, I mean, it's a rerun of last year. Ready to go tonight. 7:50, I'm assuming. Let's go. I want the Raiders to win so bad, but I can be blinded so much by who I want to win. I think the Storm might just get up in a very close one here. I don't think the margin's going to be more than 6 to 8 points. I think it's going to be a close one. But you never know. Raiders are rolling. They've just knocked over the Roosters. They knocked over the Sharks. I mean, Sharks, you know, Michael Redman knows a lot about how the Sharks have been this year. But yeah, knocking over the Roosters is a massive momentum builder, bit of confidence coming in. Storm haven't played in a week. I know some people think that's a good thing, but in finals, when teams are getting consecutive games on the park, having a week off could be harmful, especially when you're coming up against one of the premier teams. I think we're going to see a close hit out tonight. Think the Storm will just get over the top, but I'll be rooting for the Raiders all night, mate.
Yeah, my head says the Storm as well, but my heart wants the Raiders to get through. I think it's, again, essential that the Raiders keep the Storm under 20 points. It's been a while since any team's been able to keep the Storm under 20 points. Their attack is so prolific. They put 50 on the Tigers and they put 36 on the Eels. They just only score points for fun with the likes of, especially Munster, who seems to be fighting fit for tonight, along with Pappenhausen, Adekar and Ollum. That left edge attack is just prolific. So if the Raiders can go a long way to stopping that, again, I think it's all about getting up and in the channel in terms of the defensive policy there. Try and make them throw the cutout, because we all know like Pappenhausen's an effective runner of the ball as well as Munster. But just throw some different looks at them too and win the yardage battle through the middle of the field. I think that will be key. We've got Papali and Louis going up against Osofa Solomona and the boys there in Melbourne. They're a phenomenal pack. So I dare say it could be quite a physical match. But whoever gets that forward platform for their backs to play outside the off of, I think it's key because they both got the strike. It's just you can win that forward battle in the middle of the park. That's where it'll be won and lost for me.
Yeah, I mean, you've nailed it on the head there. Like, I think, but if anyone can hold the Storm to 20 points or less, it is the Raiders. I don't think there's a better suited team to come up against Melbourne in a prelim than the Raiders. Yeah. I've got hope for them. I mean, it's not so out of the ordinary for Raiders to beat Melbourne. They've beat them a few times in the past couple of years.
Like, beat them earlier this year, first game back from lockdown.
They've been one of the only teams in the NRL who's been able to beat the Storm. So if anyone can do it, it's them.
Yeah.
I guess it's just you got to turn up on the park with that mentality, the same mentality you've turned up with the last couple of times you beat them. So, I mean, they beat them in the finals last year.
Yep,
it's not
and that's the beauty of these matchups this weekend is it's effectively a cost of a coin, you know, toss of a coin, like you're losing me marbles here. So that's that game covered off there again. It'll be very captivating viewing tonight. Looking forward to watching it with a couple of the boys as well. And moving on now to tomorrow night's game, Penrith v South. Now we'll touch on Penrith in a moment, but. Just your reflections on South. Obviously, we were at that game. Rare footage of me wearing something that wasn't blue and gold, that wasn't a Sydney Uni touch gear. But that's neither here nor there. South outclassed the Eels. Can we smell what Damien is cooking?
Mate, he's unreal, that bloke. Yeah, disappointing. I was quite disappointed. As you were with me, I was pretty pumped up in the first half. 18-8 lead at half time. I was up, I was roaring. I thought we were well on our way. And then just one incident happened, I believe, that just tipped the game on its head for us, is Mitch Moses' kick. Yeah. You know, that's the difference between a 20-all game with however 20 minutes ago?
Yeah.
Or an 8-point lead with 20 minutes ago. And obviously we got the latter, which was pretty pathetic based off where the kick was placed. But
And speaking of Nostradamus, I was sitting next to you and I did say I wouldn't be surprised if he hit the post here, because I have flashbacks of 2016 where the Tigers could have beat the Gold Coast Titans to make the finals and we scored 4 tries to 3 and lost the game 20-18 because only got 1 out of 4 conversions, including missing a penalty goal with 10 to go for about the similar spot that he missed it by hitting the post. So some people will eat up pressure. Looks like Moses crumbles under it. He's at a bit of a crossroads now. I still think there's probably not a better option to replace him, and given the coin that he's on, he'll obviously still be a Parramatta there at least next year. But again, as I said earlier, this year might be the best Nostradamus so far. Is it? He's the sort of guy that take it to the second week of the finals,
yeah. But
not much further. And I feel sorry for Clint Gutherson because he's been the best player all year, and it was really just a prolific 5-minute period from him that took him from 8-0 down to an 18-8 lead. I mean, you could not get a better 5 minutes of individual play than that.
It was unreal.
Popping off a couple of offloads, got him through, and then the ability to get it in behind the fullback and get that offload when he was under severe pressure getting tackled was sensational. And then beating the set on the outside was a beautiful one-on-one. So I think he should definitely be in the Origin team. I think Freddie might slot him in at centre, given Tom Trbojevic's absence. But yeah, moving back to the matchup here, Penrith v Souths. Who are you rolling with here?
I'm rolling with Penrith. I just think Penrith are going to be too hard to beat. They're missing Kikau from suspension, but I don't think they're a one man, you know, missing one man and they lose a game. I don't think Penrith have built their team like that. I think they're all accountable together. They play well as a team. I just think the inconsistency sometimes of South play style is just like high flying and excitement around the outside backs. I just think Penrith are too well drilled to let the South take control of that game.
Yeah, look, I think you're on the money there. A lot of people jumping on South because they're such a hot, they've been such a hot team, getting over Newcastle and Parra as well. But I just think Penrith is another step up in class. And let's just say if Penrith get to an 18-8 lead, they're not blowing it.
No.
The way the Eels did.
No.
Cleary, he's one of the few halves I reckon that can play on the front foot when his team's on top in the battle, but also can play off the back foot in terms of controlling the game. And if he's up 18-8, it just gives Penrith a perfect chance to strangle you.
They're great lead holders.
They're sensational. They play that sensational style of pressure football. They got high completion, great defensive efficiency. They don't beat themselves. They don't beat themselves, and that's why it's one of the key reasons why they've gone, 16 in a row. And I just think the way South drift in and out of games, and I know attack's been a big focus here because of the rule change, but in these big championship games, you back defence over attack any day of the week, and I just think Penrith are primed here, and I think South, remember, let's not forget, they've won 3 in a row, and they've put on a great performance, and Wayne Bennett's getting all sort of plaudits, but they lost to the Dogs a month ago. They lost to the Dogs. Right, and I just don't see this happening tomorrow night. I think Penrith will win by at least 12 in this game.
Yeah, I think you're pretty right on track there. I mean, South can score a lot of points. There's no doubt they're a threat. They're a threat to a lot of teams' defences, but I think they've struck poison here with their matchup against Penrith. There's just too well drilled of a team to not get out ahead and secure their lead. Like, Parramatta let South back in the game after Parramatta went up, and that was lucky for the South. But Penrith, if they get up, I don't think there's going to be any opportunity at all for the South to come back in the game.
For sure.
They don't play the game like that.
Well, there you have it. There's our preliminary final preview. Captivating matchups. I think everyone agrees it's probably the best round of prelims in a few years. But moving on now to my beef of the week, and that again comes back to the defending premiers who are now out of the competition, the Sydney Roosters. It's been reported that Kyle Flanagan will not be renewed beyond next year. Pretty brutal, and I can understand the argument that, if he's not the right fit, then he's time to be moved on, but I find it pretty hard. This typical Roosters, they get a player in, he's young, then it's got a chance for him to develop, right? And there's been some flashes this year, he's done some good work, right? Defensively, he's always still going to be the strongest, right? You're a 21-year-old half, right? You're going to have some deficiencies in your defence, right? People are going to target you, and you went out. We saw Penrith target his channel a bit to a degree of success. But he showed plenty in attack score, plenty of tries, and I certainly think he held his own in there. But again, the Roosters, being the brutal team that they are and their inability to develop players, to only purchase players when they're at the peak of their game with a ridiculous third-party deal and the salary of sombrero, and it's just absolutely disgraceful. And it goes to show, unless you're one of the 12 Roosters fans out there, everyone else is despising you because you just undermine the length of the competition and you don't develop your own players. And that's just the reality of the situation.
Part of me thinks this is all part of a plan that they have someone else lined up that they're bringing in. I don't think... I was listening to Cooper Cronk talk about this, about how Trent Robertson backs Kyle Flanagan, the Roosters back Kyle Flanagan. He'll be there for a while. He'll develop in a Sydney Roosters jersey. This was no more than last week, mate. And then a couple of days later, here we are. Kyle Flanagan's gone. So I think they've got someone else lined up. I wouldn't be surprised if as soon as this season ends, maybe after Origin ends too, surprise, surprise, Roosters are bringing in a big half from somewhere else. So,
get rid of a player on 200,000, bring in a player worth $1 million. Yeah. How does it work out? The books are all good.
So, yeah, I think this is all part of a bigger plan. I mean, think about it. He's 21 years old. He's not a bad player. He's got a lot of development left to go. You don't just drop someone for no reason. It's just thoughtless. So, especially, who are your other options? You don't drop someone at that age with so much potential for no reason. There's someone else coming. Yeah. And that is my Nostradamus today. Sydney will sign a marquee half, one of the biggest halves in the competition after this season. That's my Nostradamus, mate. It's happening.
Well, yeah, again, that was a nice little flow in there. That was seamless. And I've got to respect that the production value there. There's been talk that around Mitchell Pearce, and I'm not sure if it's all pie in the sky, but given that he's on $1 million next year at Newcastle, he'll be at Newcastle next year because no one's going to pick up the freight for $1 million contract. But after that, in terms of their extension, there's debate about there because he'd have to take they're wanting to come down to $700,000, which is probably reasonable. He's probably overpaid at $1 million. Only the top players in the game should get $1 million. And I think Mitchell Pearce...
What's he, 30-something now?
Yeah, he'd be 30, 31. Getting towards the tail end of his career as well. And it's the pressure is on Newcastle. This is their premiership window. This is their premiership window. They've recruited well. They've got Tyson Frizzell coming next year. So he's got no excuse. He's got a couple of edge back rowers there. He's got a decent forward pack with the Saifedi brothers and Clemmer. And obviously Frizzell with the additional next year, and you got Ponga, Pearce, Kurt Mann, I thought played very well this year, and some decent outside backs. So there's no reason why they can't perform. And again, they're a bit like the Tigers, a bit of a soft underbelly up there. But at the time is now on there for Pearce, and that could really affect his next contract. So perhaps he could be that person that you're referring to.
I'm not. Nostradamus doesn't include who it's going to be, but Pearce could fit the jersey, but. Yeah, I think Pearce would be. It'd be silly for Pearce to be there to be at the Roosters next year. The Knights have been working for their team. The Knights have been working towards 2021 for a while now. So, anyone to back out on that before it happens would be pretty silly. But I'm looking forward to the Knights next year. But Roosters are signing a marquee half. And mark my words.
Yep, and I think in terms of your other Nostradamus, give us a bit of an update there. The Raiders prelim final that's been booked and that's been franked.
They made a prelim.
And then we saw a live Cam Munster field goal.
It is, which is unfortunate because I do want the Raiders to win tonight. But in order for... I think that was my first Nostradamus.
Yeah, it was.
My first Nostradamus here with political football was for Cam Munster to kick a field goal to win the grand final. So I want the Raiders to win tonight. But in order for my Nostradamus to come true, the Raiders have to take an L tonight. So we'll see what happens.
Well, there you have it. That's our league coverage for the week. Just before we wrap up the show, we've actually got a special guest joining us in. So after this short commercial break, we'll get him in and he's excited for tonight's matchup. What up? It's the Love Doctor here. Are you a New South Wales MP looking for love? Well, guess what? The Love Doctor's got the magic dust just for you. A brand new dating app, Numero Uno, coming to you with a special promotion for New South Wales parliamentary MPs. Get as many likes as you want. You want a bad boy with a few land deals that aren't particularly above board? Numero Uno is the place for you. The Love Doctor, sprinkling that bit of magic dust just where you least expect it. Well, welcome back to Political Football. We're joined here by a very special guest. We've had some great ones over the past couple of weeks. We had Dominic Thiem, of course, and Mick Ennis. Following on with our league coverage, we've got Canberra Raiders hard man, edge back rower, Johnny Bateman. How are you going, Johnny?
Oh, hey, boys. Hey, Tommy. Hey, Joy. Mate, so happy to be here. I've been listening to the podcast for a very long time. It's really good to be on here, mate. I'm pumped.
Well, I'm glad to have you on here, Johnny. You've got quite a fan base that we've got for our podcast. I love the way you play, your attacking style, leaving nothing out, getting around the boys. You excited for tonight's matchup?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited, but I had to come here and visit my favourite shop, Angry Donuts. This is why I'm in Sydney right now. I think we saw our morning run through. It was captain's runs in a minute, so... I can't be here for too long. Got to go buy Angry Donuts and get me donut. Mate, I think we can get it done tonight. I'm gonna be coming for Cam Munster's nick, mate.
Well, that's... I don't want to hold you up, Johnny, but just a couple more questions before you go, mate.
Shoot, mate.
Where do you think this matchup will be won and lost tonight? Obviously, Storm's attack is prolific. What are you going to do defensively to shape things up?
Oh, mate, up the guts. Up the guts all night, brother. I think we got the edge out wide. But yeah, big Papa. my brother, I think he's going to be up the middle all night. We're going to be in for a tough one, but yeah, I think we got this one, mate.
Yeah, I think the formula to go there. Given this is your last season in the NRL, how significant is it that you'd love to go out on a winning note with
the Raiders? Oh, massive, mate. I mean, we'll go out with a bang, yeah. We gotta get our redemption from last year. So, yeah, I think this is a big year for me. Just because I'm leaving doesn't mean I'm not committed. Very committed. I'll be giving it my all tonight, mate. And this will be my second last NRL game. I promise you that. I promise you that, bruv.
Yeah, obviously feeling a bit homesick. What will it mean to get back to your family in the UK?
Oh, everything, mate. Everything. I miss them. You know, there's been no shortness of coverage over the past few months. It's huge for me, but you know, these Raiders fellas are my family as well. So I'll be giving it my all, mate. I'll be out there with the sword on my back from Mother England, mate.
Yeah, fair enough, and no doubt the rest of your teammates will be getting that to get you that title as well, for sure. But just before we go, we saw a video emerge on social media yesterday where you were confronted by look to be a little garden spider, and you didn't want any part of it. Can you explain that? Is that you got a phobia of spiders?
Well, mate, I've been trained to tackle Nelson Afosola Mamona, mate. Okay. Nelson, big Nelson, not these little spiders that are creeping in, mate. I'm not trained for that, yeah. So, any little spiders want to come around my house? My missus has got the Mortine, so yeah. I think we deal with that speed hump pretty easily, but I'm not scared of our big Nelson. He's not like a little spider. So I'll be coming at him, mate, with the Mortine tonight.
How big was the spider? Was it tiny or?
Oh, it's humongous, mate. Have you seen the video? Size of a dinner plate.
Well, there you have it, Johnny. I don't want to hold you up, so you go get your donut and get yourself ready for game day. It's a pleasure on having you on Political Football. If you want to come on any time in the future, you're welcome to have you. And good luck tonight. Go well into battle.
Thanks, boys. I appreciate it. Loving your work. Keep it up.
Well, thanks so much for that, Johnny. Really appreciate your time on game day. I'm sure our viewers will appreciate that exclusive interview one-on-one, and best of luck tonight. Go well into battle, son. But moving on now, that is the end of this week's episode. Thanks so much for joining us here on Political Football. We appreciate your viewership. That'll be our last episode for a fortnight, but we'll be back better than ever for a big grand final review, and I'm sure another scandal isn't too far away in the political sphere. But from Joe and myself, Pools, goodbye, and enjoy your weekend. Enjoy finals football.